The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Elena Kagan, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, bonus edition, May 2nd, 2019. Attorney General Bill Barr appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday to discuss the Mueller report and the Justice Department's wider efforts to investigate Russian election interference in the 2016 election. The evening before the testimony, multiple outlets reported that Mueller had sent Barr a letter expressing concerns that the Attorney General's summary of the report's conclusions, quote, did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of the special counsel's work. The hearing became contentious and covered a wide array of topics, ranging from Barr's conduct to the Hillary Clinton email investigation. But we cut out all the unnecessary repetition and theatrics to leave you with just the questions and answers that you need to hear. It's the Lawfare Podcast bonus edition, Barr versus the Committee with No Bull.
Thank you very much. As to the actual report itself, was there ever an occasion where you wanted to, something was redacted from the report that Mr. Mueller objected to?
I wouldn't say objected to. My understanding is the categories were defined by me and the deputy. I don't think that, I have no, I don't
Did
believe.
Did you work with him to redact the report?
Right. Those categories were executed by DOJ lawyers working with his lawyers. I think there were maybe a few judgment calls, very few, as to whether or not something as a prudential matter should be treated as a reputational interest or something. So there may have been some occasions of that, but as far as I'm aware.
As I understand it, you did not want to hurt somebody's reputation unless it really affected the outcome. Is that correct?
Right.
So was there any disagreement about 6E material?
Not that I'm aware of.
Any disagreement about classified information?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. So the conclusions in your four-page summary, you think, accurately reflect his bottom line on collusion. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you can read it for yourself if you got any doubt. As to obstruction of justice, were you surprised he was going to let you decide?
Yes, I was surprised. I think the function he was carrying out, the prosecutive and investigative and prosecutive function, is performed for the purpose of making that.
How many people did he actually indict? Do you know?
I can't remember off the top of my head.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
So he actually has the ability to indict if he wants to. He's used that power during the investigation. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the other thing that was confusing to me is that the investigation carried on for a while as additional episodes were looked into, episodes right. involving the president. And so my question is, why were those investigated if at the end of the day you weren't going to reach a decision on them?
So did you consult Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein about the obstruction matter?
Constantly, yeah.
So was he in agreement with your decision not to proceed forward?
Yes. I'm sorry, the agreement what?
Not to proceed forward
right,
with obstruction.
Right.
Okay. So very quickly, give us your reasoning why you think it would be inappropriate to proceed forward on obstruction of justice in this case.
Well, generally speaking, an obstruction case typically has two aspects to it. One, there's usually an underlying criminality.
Let's stop right there.
Yeah.
was there an underlying crime here?
No.
So okay. Usually there is.
Usually. But it's not necessary, but right. the typical case, sort of the paradigmatic case is right. there's an underlying crime, and then the person implicated or people implicated, concerned about that criminality being discovered, take an inherently malignant act, as the Supreme Court has said, to obstruct that investigation,
so
such
what
as
are the
destroying
examples
documents.
That people were worried about, that he fired Comey to stop the Russian investigation. That's one of the concerns people had. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Comey. I do not have confidence in him, Comey, any longer. That was Chuck Schumer, November the 2nd, 2016. I think he, Comey, should take a hard look at what he has done, and I think it would not be a bad thing for the American people if he did step down, Bernie Sanders, January the 15th, 2017. The president ought to fire Comey immediately, and he ought to initiate an investigation. That is Congressman Nadler, November the 14th, 2016. Did you have a problem with the way Comey handled the Clinton email investigation?
Yes, I said so at the time.
Okay. So, given the fact that a lot of people, Comey, should be fired, did you find that to be a persuasive act of obstructing justice?
No. I think even the report at the end of the day came to the conclusion, if you read the analysis, that a reason that loomed large there for his termination was his refusal to tell the public what he was privately telling the president, which was that the president was not under investigation.
Mr. Attorney General, the special counsel's report describes how the president directed White House counsel Don McGahn to fire special counsel Mueller and later told McGahn to write a letter, quote, for our records, end quote, stating that the president had not ordered him to fire Mueller. The report also recounts how the president made repeated efforts to get McGahn to change his story. Knowing that McGahn believed the president's version of events was false, the special counsel found, and I quote, substantial evidence, end quote, that the president tried to change McGahn's account in order to prevent further scrutiny of the president towards the investigation. Special counsel also found that McGahn is a credible witness with no motive to lie or exaggerate given the position he held in the White House. Here's the question. Does existing law prohibit efforts to get a witness to lie, to say something the witness believes is false?
Yes. And lie to the government, yes.
And what law is that?
Obstruction statutes.
The obstruction statute. And you don't have it, I guess, before you.
Well, I'm not sure which one they were referring to here. It was probably 1512C2.
So these things, in effect, constitute obstruction.
Well, you're talking in general terms. You're not talking.
What I'm talking about specifically, yes, you're correct in a sense that the special counsel in his report found substantial evidence that the president tried to change McGahn's account in order to prevent, and this is a quote, further scrutiny of the president toward the investigation, end quote. The special counsel also found McGahn is a credible witness with no motive to lie or exaggerate. So what I'm asking you then, is that a credible charge under the obstruction statute?
We felt that that episode, the government would not be able to establish obstruction. If you look at the episode where the president gave McGahn an instruction, McGahn's version of that is quite clear, and each time he gave it, which is that the instruction said, go to Rosenstein, raise the issue of conflict of interest, and Mueller has to go because of this conflict of interest. So there's no question that whatever instruction was giving McGahn had to do with Mueller's conflict of interest. Now, the president later said that what he meant was that the conflict of interest should be raised with Rosenstein, but the decision should be left with Rosenstein. On the other end of the spectrum, it appears that McGahn felt it was more directive and that the president was essentially saying, push Rosenstein to invoke a conflict of interest to push Mueller out. Wherever it fell on that spectrum of interest, the New York Times story was very different. The New York Times story said flat out that the president directed the firing of Mueller. He told McGahn, fire Mueller. Now, that there's something very different between firing a special counsel outright, which suggests ending the investigation, and having a special counsel removed for conflict, which suggests that you're going to have another special counsel. So the fact is that even under McGahn's, and then as the report says and recognizes, there is evidence the president truly felt that the Times article was inaccurate and he wanted McGahn to correct it. So we believe that it would be impossible for the government to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that the president understood that he was instructing McGahn to say something false, because it wasn't necessarily false. Moreover, McGahn had weeks before already given testimony to the special counsel, and the president was aware of that. And as the report indicates, it could also have been the case that he was primarily concerned about press reports and making it clear that he never outright directed the firing of Mueller. So in terms of the request to ask McGahn to memorialize that fact, we do not think in this case that the government could show corrupt intent beyond a reasonable doubt.
Just to finish this, but you still have a situation where a president essentially tries to change the lawyer's account in order to prevent further criticism of himself.
Well, that's not a crime.
So you can, in this situation, instruct someone to lie?
No, it has to be, well, to be obstruction of justice, the lie has to be tied to impairing the evidence in a particular proceeding. McGahn had already given his evidence, and I think it would be plausible that the purpose of McGahn memorializing what the president was asking was to make the record that the president never directed him to fire. And there is a distinction between saying to someone, go fire him, go fire Mueller, and saying, have him removed based on conflict.
And what would
they have different results?
What would that conflict be?
Well, the difference between them is if you remove someone for a conflict of interest, then there would be presumably another person appointed.
Yeah, but wouldn't you have to have it in this kind of situation, an identifiable conflict that made sense, or else doesn't it just become a fabrication?
Well, now we're going to shift from the issue of writing the memo or somehow putting out a release later on, and the issue of the actual direction to McGahn. So the question on the direction to McGahn has a number of different levels to it. And first, as a matter of law, I think the department's position would be that the president can direct the termination or the replacement of a special counsel. And as a matter of law, the obstruction statute does not reach that conduct. Putting that aside, the next question would be, even if it reached the conduct, could you here establish corrupt intent beyond a reasonable doubt? What makes this case very interesting is that when you take away the fact that there were no underlying criminal conduct, and you take away the fact that there was no inherently malign obstructive act, that is, the president was carrying out his constitutional duties, the question is, what is the impact of taking away the underlying crime? It's not, as the report suggests, that one impact is, well, we have to find some other reason why the president would obstruct the investigation. But there's another impact, which is, if the president is being falsely accused, which the evidence now suggests that the accusations against him were false, if he knew they were false, and he felt that this investigation was unfair, propelled by his political opponents, and was hampering his ability to govern, that is not a corrupt motive for replacing an independent counsel. So that's another reason that we would say that the government would have difficulty proving this beyond a reasonable doubt.
Senator Lee.
You said the president is fully cooperating with an investigation. But his attorney had told a defendant he'd be taken care of if he didn't cooperate with the investigation. Is there a conflict in that?
I'm sorry, could you just repeat
both
that?
Both Mr. Manafort and Mr. Cohen were told by Trump's personal attorney they'd be taken care of if they did not cooperate. You said that the president was fully cooperating. Is there a conflict there? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. Do you think it's fully cooperating to instruct a former aide to tell the attorney general to unrecuse himself, shut down the investigation, and declare the president did nothing wrong?
I don't think, obviously, since I didn't find it was obstruction, I felt that the evidence could not support an obstruction.
I'm asking is that fully cooperating? Yeah. I'm not asking whether that's obstruction. Is that fully cooperating?
Yeah, he fully cooperated.
So by instructing a former aide to tell the attorney general to unrecuse himself, shut down the investigation, and declare the president did nothing wrong, that's fully cooperating.
Where is that in the report?
That is on volume 2, page 5. On June 19, 2017, the president dictated a message for Lewandowski to deliver to Sessions. The message said the Sessions should publicly announce the notwithstanding his recusal from the Russian investigation. The investigation is very unfair to the president. The president did nothing wrong.
Right.
That's cooperating.
Well, firstly, asking Sessions to unrecuse himself, we do not think is obstruction.
And declare the president did nothing wrong. I'm not asking if it's obstruction. He's cooperating.
Well, I don't know if that declares the president did nothing wrong, although the president, in terms of collusion, did nothing wrong. Isn't that correct?
Well, collusion is not a crime. It's the obstructing. But is that fully cooperating to say that?
Well, I don't see any conflict between that and fully cooperating with the investigation.
The president, of course, declared many times publicly in tweets and at campaign rallies and all that he would testify fully. He never did testify, correct?
As far as I know.
Well, I think you know whether he testified or not.
As far as I know, he didn't testify.
And Mr. Mueller found the written answers to be inadequate. Is that correct?
I think he wanted additional, but he never sought it.
And the president never testified.
Well, he never pushed it.
The president never testified.
Senator Durbin.
The Office of Legal Counsel's decision as to whether or not you can prosecute a sitting president, you had some pretty strong feelings of that, and they were reflected in your volunteered memo to the Trump defense team, your 19-page memo.
Did I discuss that?
You certainly discussed whether or not a president should cooperate with an investigation. You said at one point in summarizing the findings of Mueller that the White House fully cooperated. We know for a fact, and you've stated already, the president never submitted himself to what was characterized as a vital interview, an actual sit-down interview under oath, not once, and that his questions that were answered some 30 times, his memory failed him. So to say the White House fully cooperated, that I think is a generous conclusion. On this Office of Legal Counsel, I would refer you to this volume two of the Mueller report. And on page one, he talks about the whole issue of whether or not he was in any way restricted and what he could conclude because of the outstanding Office of Legal Counsel opinion on the liability of a sitting president. You dismissed that in your opening statement and said we asked him two or three times. He said that that had nothing to do with it. Well, how do you explain on the first page of volume two that he says it had a lot to do with it? It's a reason he couldn't reach a binary conclusion on obstruction of justice.
Well, no, it was a prudential reason. One of the backdrop factors that he cited as influencing his prudential judgment that he should not reach a decision, which is different than citing the OLC, saying that but for the OLC opinion, I would indict.
I'm just going to stand by what he has written, and I ask others to read it as well. The last point I want to make is about Don McGahn. If you read the section here, pages 113 to 120, on Don McGahn's experience, the president wanted him to state publicly that the New York Times article was untrue, that he had not asked McGahn to fire the special counsel. McGahn refused, and there's some speculation as to whether he risked being dismissed or even resigning over this issue. And for you to suggest that this was some sort of a kabuki dance with Rob Rosenstein, I think the president's intent here was very clear. He wanted this to end. He told Lester Holt, going back to the issue that was raised by the chairman earlier here, the reason to get rid of Comey is because of the Russian investigation. I mean, over and over again, this president was very explicit, and it certainly is very expository in his style. So I don't understand. Let me ask you this in conclusion. My time is up. Do you have any objections? Can you think of an objection of why Don McGahn shouldn't come and testify before this committee about his experience?
Yes. I mean, I think that he's a close advisor to the president.
Never exerted executive privilege.
Excuse me?
He may have already waived his
executive privilege. No, we haven't waived executive privilege.
Well, at this point, do you believe, you're saying, Don, what about Bob Mueller? Should he be allowed to testify before this?
I've already said publicly, I have no objection to him.
And Don McGahn, should he be allowed to testify?
That's a call for the president to make.
Well, he's a private citizen at this point, as I understand.
Well, I assume he'd be testifying about privileged matters.
Senator Whitehouse.
With respect to the OLC opinion that informed Bob Mueller's decision, as he describes in the report, do you agree that that is merely an executive opinion and that under our Constitution, the decision as to what the law is made by the judicial branch of the United States government?
I'm sorry, could you...
With respect to the OLC opinion that informed Mueller's decision not to make a recommendation on obstruction, as he said in his report, do you concede that that is an executive opinion and that under our constitutional system, what the law is gets decided by the judicial branch of government?
Yes.
Is there any way for the OLC's opinion to be tested by the judicial branch of government to see if it's correct or not?
None that comes to mind.
And it could be wrong, could it not?
I guess hypothetically it could be wrong.
And certainly there are respected legal minds that disagree with it. Correct?
Excuse me?
There are many respected legal commentators and professors and lawyers who disagree with it, correct?
It's very hard to find lawyers that agree to on anything.
So the interesting thing to me is that it goes on to say that because of the OLC opinion, we have to give the president an extra benefit of the doubt because he is denied his day in court where he could exonerate himself. That seems like a fallacy to me, because if you are the president of the United States, you can either waive or readily override the OLC opinion and say, I'm ready to go to trial. I want to exonerate myself. Let's go. Could you not?
How is this relevant to my decisions?
It's relevant
because I assumed that there was no OLC opinion.
Well, we have a report in front of us that says that this influenced the outcome. And in particular, it says it influenced the outcome because it deprived the president of his ability to have his day in court. And my point to you is that the president could easily have his day in court by simply waiving or overriding this OLC opinion that has no judicial basis. Correct?
Well, I don't think that there was anything to have a day in court on. I think that the government did not have a prosecutable case.
But part Well, Mueller obviously didn't agree because he left that up to you.
Well,
he said that he could neither confirm nor deny that there was a prosecutable case here. He left that to you. And when he did, he said, and you apparently have agreed, that this OLC opinion bears on it and that it would be unfair to the president to put him to the burden of being indicted and not having the ability to be charged.
I don't want to characterize have Bob's thought process on this.
I'm not asking you to characterize it. It's in his report. He's put it in writing.
I'm not sure what he means by that in the report.
With respect to the word, can I have a minute? I just want to nail down, you used the word spying about authorized DOJ investigative activities.
Are you talking about my testimony before the House Appropriations?
Yes. Okay. In the entirety of your previous career in the Department of Justice, including as Attorney General, have you ever referred to authorized department investigative activities officially or publicly as spying? I'm not asking for private conversation.
No, I'm not going to abjure the use of the word spying. I think my first job was in CIA, and I don't think the word spying has any pejorative connotation at all. The question is always whether or not it's authorized and adequately predicated spying. I think spying is a good English word that, in fact, doesn't have synonyms because it is the broadest word incorporating really all forms of covert intelligence collection. So I'm not going to back off the word spying, except I will say I'm not suggesting any pejorative, and I use it frequently, as do media.
When did you decide to use it? Was it off the cuff in the hearing that day, or did you go into that hearing intending to use the word spying?
It was actually off the cuff, to tell you the truth, and
Congressman, probably?
Well, from Schatz, from Hawaii.
It was here? Shaheen?
No.
Whoever it was, go ahead.
Yeah, when he challenged me and said, "Do you want to change your language?" I was actually thinking, like, "What's the issue?" I don't consider it a pejorative, but frankly, we went back and looked at press usage, and up until all the FOIA outrage a couple of weeks ago, it's commonly used in the press to refer to authorized activities, such as referring.
But it's
to the
not
FISA
commonly
court
used
the
by the
court.
Department.
What?
It is not commonly used by the department. My time is
commonly used by me.
Senator Sess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you help us understand what is legal and illegal about foreign intelligence services being involved in U.S. elections? And what should American people and the American public and especially American campaign operatives know about what's appropriate and not appropriate to take in the form of help from foreign intelligence agencies?
I mean, that's a very broad topic. What is legal and illegal? I mean, could you refine it a little bit? You're talking about what kind of propaganda, that kind of thing, coming into the country?
Could you
put money into foreign money, obviously, into a campaign.
Yeah, but you could Russia, China, I'm making up a country, decide to come into the United States and look at all the political talent, make a database. By the way, the OPM hack in 2014 tells us the Chinese government is actively involved in creating databases of people they can potentially use as leverage against American citizens. More than 20 million people are already in the spy recruitment database of the Communist Party of China. Could they come in and build a database of all campaign operatives in the U.S. and some foreign entity just decide to hire all of them and then say, why don't you go and volunteer for this campaign and you go and volunteer for that campaign? Could we have campaign chairmen and women running around the U.S., U.S. citizens who have U.S. campaign talent and experience paid for by foreign entities just choosing to volunteer on campaigns going forward? Is that legal?
If their time is paid for the purpose of participating in a campaign, I wouldn't think it's legal.
But given how sleazy so much of the city is and a whole bunch of people live on retainers of $15,000 and $20,000 and $30,000 a month, is it always obvious what you're paid for versus what you do? So some Russian oligarch just decides to start putting American campaign personnel on retainer payments and say, we may need you to lobby for something somewhere in the future. They've got views about oil pipelines and natural gas pipelines into Germany. We just hold you on retainer. And by the way, the fact that you're a person who likes to work for specific campaigns and certain parties and causes, feel free to go and avocationally do whatever the heck you want whenever you want. Is that a place we should head? Is that allowed under U.S. law today?
Well, I mean, it depends on the specific circumstances, the nature of the agreement, who the person is representing. Are they representing the interests of a foreign government? Are they a foreign agent? Are they registered? It's a slippery area, and we could sit here all day and without specifics.
I only have 7 minutes. I don't get all day, but you're the chief law enforcement officer of the United States government, and I think it would be helpful for us to have a shared understanding as we head toward the 2020 election of what campaign operatives should well understand is beyond the pale. So if the Chinese government decides to start hacking into 2020 campaigns, I would hope there's clarity from the Department of Justice about whether or not Democratic presidential campaigns and whether or not the Trump re-election campaign are allowed to say, hey, we're interested in this hacked material going forward. I think we need to have clarity about a question like that. And I think as somebody who sits not just on Judiciary, but on the Intelligence Committee, I think there are a bunch of counterintelligence investigations happening right now in the United States where campaigns don't really understand what the laws are. And I think we need a lot more clarity about it. Because I'm nearly at time, let me at least give it to you as a precise question. Under the Presidential Transitions Act, once you have a Democratic nominee for president and a Republican nominee for president, one of the things that we do is we start to brief them on, in the event that you would become the president-elect, you will need to know where we are in different national security issues. Should we be adding to the Presidential Transition Act counterintelligence briefings for campaigns as they become the nominee in a much more detailed way than the response you had about the Bureau's efforts when Senator Cornyn asked if defensive briefings were given? Should we, the Congress, be thinking very intentionally about authorizing the ability of the Bureau, and in a shared, broader IC context, but with the Bureau or Homeland Security probably being the interface entity, should nominees for the highest office in the land heading into 2020 be receiving regular counterintelligence briefings on the fact that foreign intelligence services are going to surround people that are likely going to be people of influence and principal officers of the United States government should they win?
Absolutely. I think the danger from countries like China, Russia, and so forth is far more insidious than it has been in the past because of non-traditional collectors that they have operating in the United States. And I think most people are unaware of how pervasive it is and what the risk level is. And I think it actually should go far beyond even campaigns. More people involved in government have to be educated on this.
Senator Coons.
Let me move on to a point that Senator Sasse was just asking, but that I think is worth revisiting, about foreign intelligence and their role in our elections. The reason we had this investigation in the first place was George Papadopoulos was told the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton. The Russians had a direct contact to Donald Trump Jr. and offered to give dirt about his father's opponent. Donald Trump Jr. said, I love it, and invited the campaign chairman and president's son-in-law to the campaign chairman to a meeting with the Russians to get it.
Who did you say offered it? Who did you say offered it?
In the second instance, it was Russians made an offer to Donald Trump. I have 30 seconds.
Okay.
Let me get to a question if I could. Going forward, what if a foreign adversary, let's now say North Korea, offers a presidential candidate dirt on a competitor in 2020? Do you agree with me the campaign should immediately contact the FBI? If a foreign intelligence service, a representative of a foreign government,
yes,
says, we have dirt on your opponent,
yes,
should they say, I love it, let's meet, or should they contact the FBI?
If a foreign intelligence service does, yes.
Okay, here's my core concern. The president ordered the White House counsel to have Special Counsel Mueller fired. He fabricated evidence to cover it up. And whether or not you could make a criminal charge of this, it is unacceptable. And everyone who said we didn't have to worry about President Trump firing the special counsel was flat out wrong. The Russians offered the Trump campaign dirt on Hillary Clinton, and the Trump campaign never reported that to the FBI. Instead, they tried to conceal the meeting and misled the American people. And I think we have to work on a bipartisan basis going forward to protect our elections from a repeat of this, and we need your leadership and the president's.
Senator Blumenthal.
You ignored in that press conference and in the summary that Robert Mueller found substantial evidence, and it's in the report. And we have a chart that
shows the elements of that crime, intent, interference with an ongoing investigation, and the obstructive act. So I think that your credibility is undermined within the department, in this committee, and with the American people. And I want to ask you whether on those remaining investigations, the 12 to 14 investigations, whether you have had any communication with anyone in the White House?
No.
And will you give us an ironclad commitment that you will in no way interfere?
By the way, I'm not sure, you know, the laundry list of investigations, but I certainly haven't talked the substance or been directed to do anything on any of the cases.
Well, let me give you an opportunity to clarify. Yeah. Have you had any conversations with anyone in the White House about those ongoing investigations that were spawned or spun off by...
I don't recall having any substantive discussion on the investigation.
Have you had any non-substantive discussion?
I mean, it's possible that a name of a case was mentioned.
And have you provided information about any of those ongoing investigations? Any information whatsoever?
I don't recall, no.
You don't recall?
I don't recall providing any.
Wouldn't you recall about whether you gave information to somebody in the White House about an ongoing criminal investigation in the Southern District of New York or the Eastern District of New York or the Eastern District of Virginia or the Department of Justice?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't recall providing any substantive information about a case.
Is there anything that would refresh your recollection?
If I probably looked over a list of cases and thought about it. But I don't recall discussing.
You know what those investigations are. We've discussed them at your confirmation hearing, correct?
Well, I think there's 12 or 18 cases, right?
You don't know what those investigations are, Mr. Turner?
I do generally, but I can't remember each of
them. And let me ask you one last time. You can't recall whether you have discussed those cases with anyone in the White House, including the President of the United States?
My recollection is I have not discussed those.
But you don't recall for sure. Let me move on.
I can say very surely I did not discuss the substance of any.
Will you recuse yourself from those investigations?
No.
Let me ask you about a couple of quotes from the president, since a number of my colleagues have raised the Russia investigation. And these are from the report, untruths recited by the report from the president in December of 2016, when President Trump was asked about the intelligence community's conclusion that Russia interfered in our election to boost Trump's chances. He said he had, quote, no idea if it's Russia, China, or somebody. It could be somebody sitting in a bed someplace.
400-pound person.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman?
400-pound person sitting on a bed.
That isn't what the president said. He referred to it as somebody. He also, at Helsinki, denied Russian attacks in 2016 on our election. Another lie. 2 days after President Trump was elected, Russian officials told the press that the Russian government had maintained contacts with Trump's, quote, immediate entourage, end quote, during the campaign. When President Trump was asked about it, he said, quote, there was no communication between the campaign and any foreign entity during the campaign. That's at page 21 of volume 2. The first quote I gave you was from page 21 of volume 2. The president initially denied playing any role in shaping his son's statement to the press about the now infamous June 9th meeting. The Mueller report established that the president dictated a misleading statement about that meeting through his communications director, Hope Hicks. That's at page 101 and 102 of volume 2. After news organizations reported that the president ordered Mr. McGahn, to have the special counsel removed, the president publicly disputed these accounts. The Mueller report establishes that, quote, substantial evidence supports the conclusion that the president, in fact, directed McGahn to call Rosenstein to have the special counsel removed. That's at volume 2, page 88. In your view, did President Trump, on those occasions and others recited in the report, lie to the American people?
Well, I'm not in the business of determining when lies are told to the American people. I'm in the business of determining whether a crime has been committed.
So he may have lied.
But I'd like an opportunity to answer some of these questions, okay? You started by citing this thing in volume two about how the report says that they could not be sure that they could clearly say that he did not violate the law. As you know, that's not the standard we use in the criminal justice system. It's presumed that someone is innocent, and the government has to prove that they clearly violated the law. We're not in the business of exoneration. We're not in the business of proving they didn't violate the law.
But you, in effect, exonerated him in your press conference and in your four-page summary.
How did that start? I didn't hear the beginning of the question.
You, in effect, exonerated or cleared the president?
No, I didn't exonerate. I said that we did not believe that there was sufficient evidence to establish an obstruction offense, which is the job of the Justice Department. And the job of the Justice Department is now over. That determines whether or not there's a crime. The report is now in the hands of the American people. Everyone can decide for themselves. There's an election in 18 months. That's a very democratic process. But we're out of it. And we have to stop using the criminal justice process as a political weapon.
Thank you, Senator Ernst.
General Barr, the past 2 years, we've been talking about this investigation in terms of what happened, and now we have the opportunity to decide how to do better. So the special counsel's report is the end of the road. I think many have stated that. The end of the road when it comes to the question of the Trump administration's intent, but it is just the beginning of the conversation on how we counter Russia and other foreign adversaries in their attempts to undermine our republic. So if we can talk about that 2016 presidential election, do you see vulnerabilities or weaknesses that existed at that time that left us open to foreign aggression, foreign influence in the election system? And then how do we move forward through the Department of Justice and making sure we're shoring up some of those avenues of approach of our foreign adversaries?
Yes. The FBI, you know, has a very robust program, the Foreign Influence Task Force, which is focused on this problem and is working to counteract and prepare for the kinds of interference that we have seen. And it's a very dynamic program. I've been briefed on it by Chris Wray, and I'm very impressed with what they're up to. I think that the way I view this general problem is there has always been efforts by Russia and other hostile countries to influence American elections and public opinion, but it was more easily detectable, and it was sort of a cruder operation in the past. And what we have now is, with technology and the democratization of information, the danger is far more insidious. And it enables not only them getting into effectively our whole communication system here in the United States, and I mean just the way we communicate with each other and into our business systems, our infrastructure, but it also allows them to do exactly what we've seen, which is, because of our robust First Amendment freedoms, they're able to come in and pretend they're Americans and affect the dialogue and the social dynamics in the United States in a way that they've never been able to do before. And it's a huge challenge to deal with it, but I think the intelligence community is responding to the challenge and the threat. I think I had this discussion with Bob Mueller on March 5th when he was briefing me on his work and discussing lessons learned, what he has seen in dismantling the threats that he, you know, was able to detect, and how we can start using that approach across the board.
We've accomplished a lot through our federal agencies and through the Department of Justice then. Are we able to work with different social media giants, other private organizations to help counter some of this? Do you see that they are actually stepping up to this challenge, taking this on, and making sure that they are pushing back as well against what they might determine as a foreign adversary?
Yes, I think the private companies are stepping up their game and being more responsible in addressing it.
Senator Booker.
You said, quote, "We know that the Russian operatives who perpetrated these schemes did not have the cooperation of President Trump or the Trump campaign. That is something that all Americans can and should be grateful to have confirmed." The things I just mentioned, a willingness to meet with Russian operatives in order to capitalize on information, I don't think that's something that should be grateful. I find your choice of words alarming. I think it calls into question your objectivity when you look at the actual context of the report. And so should the American people really be grateful that a candidate for president sought to benefit from material and information that was stolen by a foreign power in an effort to influence an election?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by seek to benefit. There's no indication that they engaged in either the conspiracy to hack or that they engaged in any action with respect to the dissemination that was criminal.
Well, again, sir, you're using the word conspiracy, which is a legal term. In that press conference, you used President Trump's words, obstruction, over and over again.
Obstruction's a legal term.
Well, sir, you pulled into his words, and I'm asking you specifically. Collusion was the word I was looking for. You use the word no collusion over and over again. And you said the American people should be grateful that the president sought to benefit from material and information. But you know they did seek to benefit from that material. Donald Trump Jr. in his own email seemed to celebrate that he might have access to information from a foreign adversary. Is that correct? Is that something the American people should be grateful for?
Apparently, according to the report, he was... he was interested in seeing what this Russian woman had in the way of, quote,
and did not report it, as I think everybody who's in politics knows it's something you should do. Should the American people be grateful that in the face of our attack on our democracy by a foreign adversary, that the President of the United States made several documented attempts to thwart an investigation into the links between his campaigns and Russia? You use that word grateful again, that the American people should be grateful. Is that something we should be grateful for?
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Sir, I'm talking about the attempts that this president made that Mueller pointed to, at least 10 attempts to thwart an investigation into the links between his campaign and Russia. Should we be grateful for those 10 well-documented attempts by Mueller?
Are you talking about the obstruction part of the report?
I'm talking about the second volume, let me continue. Should the American people be grateful that the Trump had more than 215 documented contacts between Russian-linked operatives and then lied about them and tried to hide them? Is that something the American people should be grateful for any president, this one or any down the road?
As I mentioned earlier, during a campaign, foreign governments make, and foreign citizens frequently make, a lot of attempts to contact different campaigns. If we were right now to go and look at, for example, Hillary Clinton's campaign during the same time frame, then you would see a lot of foreign governments,
sir,
like Chinese, trying to establish.
And that's, I guess, what I'm trying to say to you, sir, is that we right now have a new normal in our country. We have a document that shows over 200 connections between a presidential campaign and a foreign adversary, sharing information that would be illegal if you did it with a super PAC. We know that. But
what information was shared?
Polling data was shared, sir. It's in the report. I can cite you the page.
With who?
And I guess my point is that your willingness to seem to brush over this and use words like the American people should be grateful. What's in this report? Nobody should be grateful. Concerted efforts for deception, for misleading, inappropriate action after inappropriate action, that is clear. And then on top of that, At a time that we all recognize that we had a foreign power trying to undermine our election, you, the chief law enforcement officer, not only undermines your own credibility as an independent actor, when there's ongoing investigation still, using the word president's own words, having it criticized by the Mueller himself, but the challenge we now have is that we are going into an area where you seem to not even be willing to be in the least bit critical in your summarizations. I believe that calls in your credibility, and again, my time is up.
Senator Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attorney General Barr, has the President or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone? Yes or no?
Could you repeat that question?
I will repeat it. Yeah. Has the President or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone? Yes or no, please, sir?
The President or anybody else?
Seems you'd remember something like that and be able to tell us.
Yeah, but I'm trying to grapple with the word suggest. I mean, there have been discussions of matters out there that they have not asked me to open an investigation. But
perhaps they've suggested?
I don't know. I wouldn't say suggest.
Hinted?
I don't know.
Inferred? You don't know. Okay. In your March 24th summary, you wrote that, quote, after reviewing the special counsel's final report.
But I will say that no one.
Sir, I'm asking a question. Yeah. In your March 24th summary, you wrote that, quote, after reviewing the special counsel's final report, Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein and I have concluded that the evidence is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense. Now, the special counsel's investigation produced a great deal of evidence. I'm led to believe it included witnesses' notes and emails, witnesses' congressional testimony, witnesses' interviews, which were summarized in the FBI 302 forms, former FBI Director Comey's memos, and the president's public statements. My question is, in reaching your conclusion, did you personally review all of the underlying evidence?
No, we took and accepted
Mr. Rosenstein?
No, we accepted the statements in the report as the factual record. We did not go underneath it to see whether or not they were accurate. We accepted it as accurate and made our.
So you accepted the report as the evidence?
Yes.
You did not question or look at the underlying evidence that supports the conclusions in the report?
No.
Did Mr. Rosenstein review the evidence that underlines and supports the conclusions in the report, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge. We accepted the statements in the report.
Did
and
anyone
the characterization
in your,
of the evidence is true.
Did anyone in your executive office review the evidence supporting the report?
No.
No. Yet you represented to the American public that the evidence was not, quote, sufficient to support an obstruction of justice
the evidence
offense.
The evidence presented in the report. This is not a mysterious process. In the Department of Justice, we have PROS memos and declination memos every day coming up. And we don't go and look at the underlying evidence.
Would you support
the characterization of the evidence as true?
As the Attorney General of the United States, you run the United States Department of Justice. If in any U.S. Attorney's office around the country, the head of that office, when being asked to make a critical decision about, in this case, the person who holds the highest office in the land, mm-hmm. and whether or not that person committed a crime, would you accept them recommending a charging decision to you if they had not reviewed the evidence?
Well, that's a question for Bob Mueller. He's the U.S. attorney. He's the one who presents the report.
But it was you who made the charging decision, sir.
What?
You made the decision not to charge the president.
No, in a PROS memo and in a declination memo.
You said it was your baby. What did you mean by that?
It was my baby to decide whether or not to disclose it to the public.
And whose decision who had the power to make the decision about whether or not the evidence was sufficient to make a determination of whether there had been an obstruction of justice?
Prosecution memos go up to the supervisor. In this case, it was the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General who decide on the final decision.
And that is based on the memo as presented by the U.S. Attorney's Office.
I think you've made it clear that you've not looked at the evidence. We can move on. I think you've made it clear, sir, that you've not looked at the evidence, and we can move on. Will you agree to consult career DOJ ethics officials about whether your recusal from the 14 investigations that have been discussed by my colleagues is necessary?
I don't see any basis for it. I already consulted with them, and
you have consulted with them about the 14 other investigations?
About the Mueller case.
Have you consulted with the career DOJ ethics officials about the appropriateness of you being involved or recusing yourself from the 14 other investigations that have been referred out?
On what basis?
Conflict of interest, clear conflict of interest.
What's my conflict of interest?
I think the American public has seen quite well that you are biased in this situation and you've not been objective, and that would arguably be the conflict of interest.
Well, you know, I haven't been the only decision maker here. Now, let's take the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who was approved by this Senate 94-6 with specific discussion on the floor that he would be responsible for supervising the Russian investigation.
I'm glad you brought up that.
Okay.
That's
and
a great topic.
He has 30 years experience, and we had a number of senior prosecutors in the department involved in this process, both career and non-career.
Yes, I've read the process, sir.
Disposition.
I have another question. And I'm glad you brought that subject up because I have a question about that. Earlier today, in response to Senator Graham, you said, quote, that you consulted with Rosenstein constantly, unquote, with respect to the special counsel's investigation and report. But Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein is also a key witness in the firing of FBI Director Comey. Did you consult Did you consult with DOJ ethics officials before you enlisted Rod Rosenstein to participate in a charging decision for an investigation, the subject of which he is also a witness?
My understanding was that he had been cleared already to participate in it by the.
So you had consulted with them and they cleared it?
No, I think they cleared it when he took over the investigation.
Did you consult?
That's my understanding.
You don't know whether he's been cleared of a conflict of interest?
He would be participating if there was a conflict of interest.
So you're saying that it did not need to be reviewed by the career ethics officials in your office?
I believe it was appropriate. Well, I believe it was reviewed, and I would also point out this seems to be a bit of a flip-flop, because when the president's supporters were challenging
Rosenstein.
Sir, flip-flop,
I think, in this case is that you're not answering the question directly.
What?
Did the ethics officials in your office, in the Department of Justice, review the appropriateness of Rod Rosenstein being a part of making a charging decision on an investigation which he is also a witness in?
Yeah, so as I said, my understanding was he had been cleared, and he had been cleared before I arrived.
Making a decision on the Mueller report?
Yes.
And the findings of whether or not the case would be charged on obstruction of justice, he had been cleared on that?
He was the acting attorney general on the Mueller investigation.
Had he been cleared?
He had been.
I am informed
that before I arrived, he had been cleared by the ethics officials.
Of what?
Serving as acting attorney general on the Mueller case.
How about making a charging decision on obstruction of justice?
That is
the underlying offenses, which include him as a witness.
You know, that's what the acting attorney general's job is.
To be a witness and to make the decision about being a prosecutor?
Well, no, but to make charging decisions.
Senator Leahy?
Senator Feinstein noted that she felt the FBI would be derelict in duty if it did not investigate after learning from Australia. Not the Trump administration, but Australia. The Trump campaign knew Russia had stolen Democratic emails before the victims knew. And they were told the Russians could assist in a campaign with the stolen emails. The FBI was right to look into it. That resulted, of course, in 37 indictments. But let me ask you, Mr. Barr, in your March 24 letter, you claim that the lack of evidence of an underlying crime bears on whether the president had the requisite intent to commit obstruction of justice. Well, there are numerous reasons why somebody might interfere with investigations. Most critically, an interference may prevent the discovery of an underlying crime. So interfering, you might not know if there's a crime. But the special counsel did uncover evidence of underlying crimes here, including one that directly implicated the president. And didn't we learn due to the special counsel's investigation that Donald Trump is known as Individual One in the Southern District of New York, directing hush payments as part of a criminal scheme to violate campaign finance laws? That matter was discovered by a special counsel referred to the Southern District of New York. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you. And we have, the Mueller report references a dozen ongoing investigations stemming from the special counsel's investigation. Will you commit that you will not interfere with those investigations?
Sure. Can you say?
Do you commit that you will not interfere with the dozen ongoing investigations?
I will supervise those investigations as Attorney General.
We let them reach natural conclusions without interference from the White House. Let me put it that way then.
Yes.
Thank you.
As I said when I was up for confirmation, part of my responsibility is to make sure there is no political interference in cases.
Well, and you testified a number of things, and that's why I'm double-checking. You, in the Appropriations Committee, I asked you whether Mr. Mueller expressed any expectation or interest in leaving the obstruction decision to Congress, and you testified he didn't say that to you. Actually, as you said, he didn't say that to me.
Right.
But then he has numerous references in his report to Congress playing a role in deciding whether the president committed obstruction of justice. So I know you testified many times, but that testimony was not correct.
That's not correct. I think it is correct. I mean, I don't, he has not said that he conducted the investigation in order to turn it over to Congress. That would be very inappropriate. That's not what the Justice Department does.
He included numerous references, report to Congress playing a role in it. Volume 2, page 8, conclusion that Congress may apply the obstruction laws to the president's corrupt exercise of the powers of office in accordance with our constitutional system of justice.
I don't think Bob Mueller was suggesting that the next step here was for him to turn this stuff over to Congress to act upon. That's not why we conduct grand jury investigations.
And President Trump, I am correct in my earlier statement, never allowed anybody to interview him directly under oath. Is that correct?
I think that's correct.
Even though he said he was ready to testify. Thank you.
Well, could I?
Sure.
A point you raised about the absence of a underlying crime. One point I was trying to make earlier is the absence of an underlying crime doesn't necessarily mean that there would be other motives for obstruction, although it gets a little bit harder to prove and more speculative as to what those motives might be. But the point I was trying to make earlier is that in the situation of the president, who has constitutional authority to supervise proceedings, if in fact a proceeding was not well-founded, if it was a groundless proceeding, if it was based on false allegations, the president does not have to sit there constitutionally and allow it to run its course. The president could terminate that proceeding, and it would not be a corrupt intent because he was being falsely accused, and he would be worried about the impact on his administration. That's important because most of the obstruction claims that are being made here or episodes do involve the exercise of the president's constitutional authority. And we now know that he was being falsely accused.
Let's start with Senator Klobuchar and see if we can do this.
Last question, are the president's actions detailed in this report consistent with his oath of office and the requirement in the Constitution that he take care that the laws be faithfully executed?
Is what consistent with that?
I said, are the president's actions detailed in the report consistent with his oath of office and the requirement in the Constitution that he take care that the laws be faithfully executed?
Well, the evidence in the report is conflicting, and there's different evidence, and they don't come to a determination as to how they're coming down on it.
And so you made that decision.
Yes, and as you know, if it's if
we, all right, we got
okay.
2 minutes left. Senator Blumenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attorney General Barr, I wonder if you could tell us about the conversation between yourself and Bob Mueller shortly after your summary was issued. He called you?
No, I called him.
What prompted you to call him?
The letter.
Your letter? Or his letter?
His letter.
His letter. So you called him?
Yeah.
And how long did the conversation last?
I don't know, maybe 10, 15 minutes. There were multiple witnesses in the room. It was on the speakerphone.
Who was in the room?
Among others, the Deputy Attorney General was in the room.
Anyone else?
Several other people who had been working on the project.
Members of your staff?
Yes, and the deputy staff.
And as best you can recall, in the language that was used, who said what to whom?
I said, Bob, what's with the letter? You know, why don't you just pick up the phone and call me if there's an issue? And he said that they were concerned about the way the media was playing this and felt that it was important to get out the summaries, which they felt would put their work in proper context and avoid some of the confusion that was emerging. And I asked him if he felt that my letter was misleading or inaccurate. And he said no, that the press, he felt that the press coverage was, and it was, and that a more complete picture of his thoughts and the context and so forth would deal with that. And I suggested that I would rather just get the whole report out than just putting out stuff seriatim and piecemeal. And but I said I would think about it some more. And the next day I put out a letter that made it clear that no one should read the March 24th letter as a summary of the overall report, and that a full account of Bob's Mueller's thinking was going to be in the report, and everyone would have access to
it. But there's nothing in Robert Mueller's letter to you about the press. His complaint to you is about your characterization of the report, correct?
Well, the letter speaks for itself.
It does, and in fact, in response to your question, why not just pick up the phone? This letter was an extraordinary act, a career prosecutor rebuking the Attorney General of the United States, memorializing in writing, right? I know of no other instance of that happening. Do you?
I don't consider Bob at this stage a career prosecutor. He's had a career as a prosecutor.
Well, he's a very eminent prosecutor.
He was the head of the FBI for 12 years.
He's a career.
He's had a
law enforcement career, yes. Professional.
Right.
Yep.
I know of no other instance of.
But he was also a political appointee, and he was a political appointee with me at the Department of Justice. I don't, you know, the letter's a bit snitty, and I think it was probably written by one of his staff people.
Did you make a memorandum of your conversation?
Huh?
Did you make a memorandum?
No, I didn't.
Or did anyone else?
What?
Did anyone, either you or anyone on your staff, memorialize your conversation with Robert Mueller?
Yes.
Who did that?
There were notes taken of the call.
May we have those notes?
No.
Why not?
Why should you have them?
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please get on Facebook and Twitter and tell your friends and followers about the Lawfare podcast, and give us a rating and a review wherever you listen to us. You can purchase Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. This episode was edited by me, Elena Kagan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.